You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Murray Colvin, the intrepid eyepatch-wearing veteran war correspondent for the Sunday Times of London, once wrote, "There's no way to cover war properly without risk. Covering a war means going into places torn by chaos, destruction, death, and pain, and trying to bear witness to that." She was killed in Syria in February 2012 while reporting on civilian suffering during the army siege of the city of Homs. Now, as we come up on the anniversary of Marie Colvin's death, two books about her life and work have been released. One, On the Front Line, is a collection of her best journalism and contains an introduction by her sister, Kat Colvin. The other, Under the Wire, was written by Paul Conroy, a photojournalist who was working with Marie in Syria when she died. The books are published respectively by HarperCollins and by Weinstein Books. I'm very pleased that they have brought Kat Colvin and Paul Conroy to our show today. Hello.
Hello,
how are you doing?
A word I've heard most often used to describe Marie Colvin is legendary. That word gets thrown around a bit. But Kat, as her sister, did she seem like a legend to you?
Actually, she was always my hero. I adored Marie from a young age, but I thought of her more as caring and empathetic.
Paul, you've said that you jumped at the chance to go to Syria as a photographer with Marie on what turned out to be her last assignment. You'd worked together in Libya the previous year. What did you like best about working with her?
Oh, the list is actually too long to go into in great deal. It was a spirit of, you know, there is the story. Nothing will stop us. She was so tenacious, honest, would not give up, would not say no, and it was determined to get to the very heart of war. You know, war affects the people on the ground the most. The people at the sharp end of the stick were the people whose story she was after, and that matched exactly with what I sought to do. So it was just a lovely combination of it was a great team.
Well, Kat, this book contains articles Marie wrote from Syria, Iraq, Libya, Kosovo, Chechnya, East Timor, Ethiopia, Sri Lanka. A lot of troubled areas, and there were many more. Were you able to understand what drew her to that kind of reporting?
Well, I had the most amazing view of the news, and I thought Paul really captured it in his book. He captured her spirit and what goes into getting these stories that I think so many of us take for granted. So I would get calls from Marie from all those places, you know, holding the phone up in Tahrir Square or calling from the compound in East Timor where she was absolutely certain she wouldn't make it through the night, you know, saying goodbye. But life with Marie was an adventure. You know, I receive the news differently now, and I miss that. I think Marie would love to see Paul's book because it does really put her efforts and into context. I think it's a great companion for her collected writings.
Paul, you first met Marie in Syria in 2003, before the current conflict began, after you tried unsuccessfully and illegally to cross into Iraq to photograph the U.S.'s assault on Baghdad. Hadn't you tried to get into Iraq by crossing the Tigris River in a boat that you'd made from old tires?
Sounds like Marie.
Looking back with hindsight, probably not the best thing to do. But Marie, when she'd heard of this story, I was kind of shunned by the other press for trying, really. They were all waiting on a piece of paper from the Syrian secret police that I knew wasn't coming, and I'd been waiting about a month. So I made this audacious attempt to get in. But when I got back to the hotel, everybody was like, oh, you've spoilt it for other people. You know, you're going to mess things up now. But when Marie came into the room, her first words to me ever were, "Who and where is the boatman?" and I kind of rather sheepishly put up my hand in the corner because no one else would. I was like a pariah. And Marie just strode across, put out her hand and said, "Marie Colvin, I love your story." Sat down and we over a drink, we bonded that night in a dusty desert town called the Petroleum Hotel in Commissley, which was one of the least salubrious hotels I've ever stayed in.
And then you found out that you shared...
That was our friendship was born that day.
And then you found out you shared a love of ocean sailing. Didn't Marie later use sailing to help her recover from post-traumatic stress that she had developed after she'd been injured covering the Civil War in Sri Lanka in 2001?
Marie, the way Marie sailed was not relaxing, but yes, she absolutely did. But she took on these very, very competitive races, often with experimental boats that would, you know, be trying out new materials. So masts would snap, they would get caught in whirlpools. Paul's story about the boat makes me laugh because I didn't talk about world politics with my sister, but I often talked about how she was going to get in to one war zone or another. And I remember one plan she had to pretend she was a potato in the back of a truck that was going to... Marie, that's insane.
To get among the potatoes.
You can pull off a lot, but you cannot pull off a potato.
Well, how did she how did she lose the use of one eye?
Well, she was in Sri Lanka in rebel-controlled territory trying to cross back into across government lines. And they were attacked. She was actually with a civilian group. She jumped up, yelled "journalist," and they fired at her, which the shrapnel went into her eye, also into her chest and lungs. It was a really harrowing experience. They force marched her.
It was 4 or 5 days before she got any medical treatment.
Right. And, you know, what? There's so many unsung heroes in trying to get her out, but one person who just helped enormously. It shows what close bonds Marie formed to people. It was a stringer she had worked with in Sri Lanka, you know, 15, 20 years before, who always remembered her and kept it out of the news.
Which, now, who shot at her in Sri Lanka? Was it...
Government forces. The military took her...
So it wasn't the Tamil Tigers.
No, she was... she had snuck in to interview the Tamil Tigers, who had been incommunicado for about 8 years at that point, and they reached out to her to come in and tell their story.
Now, Paul, we've been hearing in recent years about how endangered journalists are. In the past, you could yell "journalists" and they would have left you alone. Now they shoot at you. Why do you think that's changed?
I think, it really is a definite fact. I can remember roaming around the Balkans, and you know, you could get through a checkpoint with a bottle of scotch and 200 cigarettes. I think it's a part of it is the speed with now we can file stories and get pictures out means that information has always been a part of war, but now the speed that information travels and the way that a journalist can directly influence battles or just moments on the ground almost immediately, that's been recognized by governments. And you know it's another form of power. You know, the power of the press has been recognised because of the immediacy. And now that if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, telling the wrong story, you do become a target.
I'm talking with Paul Conroy, his book Under the Wire: Marie Colvin's Final Assignment, and with Kat Colvin, Marie's sister, who has put together a collection of journalism from Marie Colvin called On the Front Line. Both of these books feature pictures of Marie with the eye patch on. So she started wearing that black eye patch right after this event. She at least in public, did she wear it when she was at home?
No, she didn't. Her eye was, they had managed to save her eye. There was no vision in it, but it didn't track with her other, so she thought she looked wonky. She really was private about it. But the patch, I think, really became her badge of honor. She took a lot of pride in it, but didn't wear it around the house.
Well, Paul, did you get the sense that she was, that she was ever embarrassed about having to wear it? Or was it the badge of honor?
No, she was never embarrassed. In fact, when we went into Syria, we had to meet groups and groups of people who verified us and checked out that we were in fact real journalists, etc. But she was asked not to wear it in Syria due to the fact that, you know, they didn't want her to stand out in any way because we went in illegally. So she was asked not to wear it, and she had no problems not wearing it, but in many, many circumstances in Libya, etc., it would be something that, you know, it actually helped us in many situations. People knew of her, people recognized her, And we could go back to a place two, three times, and they would always go, you know, it's the girl with the patch. And for that, that worked well for us. But when it came to taking it off, she had no qualms. You know, it was advised, and she took that advice.
It suited her, didn't it, Paul? She had sort of a pirate aspect to her.
Absolutely.
Yeah, now,
when she used to take it off, I was like, oh, come on. It went really well with her jackets.
Well, we'll talk about her clothing in just a moment. But, Kat, other than sailing, how did she deal with her PTSD?
You know, one of the when she was at her worst, I flew over to London with my then 6-year-old daughter, and she called and would stay in touch with me and my daughter, and I really felt like that puppy love that my daughter felt for her, and just the life I was living that was so calm and familiar.
Well, you had lived in Chile and Venezuela. That doesn't sound as calm as many people's lives.
But at this point, when Marie was really in the throes of it, it hit very severely, really a year or two after her injury. I think that she loved sharing time with my daughter, just shopping and horseback riding and doing things like that that were with no need to discuss how she felt and make a big deal of it. She really didn't like to make a big deal of it. And I thought the other thing that really, more than anything else, helped her recover, and I know there's been a lot of contrary sort of information on this, was the Arab Spring. I hadn't heard her in years so enthusiastic and alive. She was so excited by it. I felt like she was really on her game. People have said she took risks, but I thought that really helped her pull out of everything.
Well, before he went to Libya, Tim Hetherington talked about retiring. Did Marie ever talk about retiring?
We joked about it often, and her best plan was to live in my attic, and I was just supposed to get a dumbwaiter to send vodka up because she did not want to get old and retire.
We had ideas
of going to the beach and just sailing and never getting off the boat, and retirement was not something she looked forward to.
She was well known for her stylish dress. She had great shoes, famously wore designer silk underwear under her flak jacket in war zones. She also wore a strand of pearls that she'd been given by Yasser Arafat.
Yeah. She pearls were very symbolic for Marie. I think that purity and the perfect circle and the perfect world. And she loved pearls. And I'm sure Arafat knew that. Everybody did.
Paul, did she ever talk about why and how she had developed close working relationships with Yasser Arafat and also Muammar Gaddafi, not exactly the most lovable people that ever lived?
I think Marie could actually charm anyone. She was fantastic at that. You know, from the top down, you know, Yasser Arafat and, you know, Gaddafi especially really did have a thing for her. He would send nurses in the night to her room, etc. But she just had that manner that I can remember the day we found that we tracked down the guy, the young lad, 18, 19-year-old, who actually found Gaddafi in the culvert. He was the one who went, "My God, there's Gaddafi." And this guy was so nervous and didn't want to talk to anybody about what had happened because obviously Gaddafi was killed moments later. But this lad was stood there not talking. And Marie kind of saw that she was onto something. And by cracking the ice, this guy was shivering. So she took off the leather jacket she was wearing, put it round his shoulders, and this lad was laughing, and all the other rebels around him were laughing. And she's gone, "Go on, you can keep the jacket, it's no problem," and wrapped him up, and he's gone, "Oh, no, it's okay." And within 10 minutes of it had been rather frosty and, you know, kind of standing on the edge of a great story, you know, this young lad was laughing his head off. All the other rebels were poking fun at him for having Marie's jacket on. And 15 minutes later, he was telling the story of exactly how he found Gaddafi. And, you know, it was just such a unique way of operating. And so I can see exactly how Gaddafi and Yasser Arafat and, you know, probably some other crackpots around the world fell for her charms. She was amazing at exactly that. You know, that's where a lot of her insight came from.
You've included lots of funny stories in your book, including a recurring one about Marie struggling to get her boots on and off. And then back on again, then off again. Because when you're in a Muslim country, you need to remove your shoes whenever you enter a building?
That's right. And Marie had the body armor and multiple layers of clothing on, which just meant the simple art of bending over was a struggle, and it was dark. And because Marie only had the sight in one eye, it became this kind of standing joke. You know, I would tell her to just, you know, not fasten her boots up because we'll be getting out shortly. And she was fantastically sharp-minded and razor-like. But when it came to certain things, like bending over with full body armor on, and she had Jim Muir's long johns, who she borrowed on, was wrapped up like a turkey. It was just a joke, you know. It was like, you know, wear slippers or something.
My guests are Paul Conroy, whose book Under the Wire, Marie Colvin's Final Assignment, published by Weinstein Books, and Kat Colvin, whose book On the Front Line, The Collected Journalism of Marie Colvin, is published by Harper Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Kat Colvin, who has put together a book called On the Front Line, The Collected Journalism of Marie Colvin. It is published by Harper Press. And Paul Conroy, the great photojournalist, who has written a book called Under the Wire, Marie Colvin's Final Assignment. It is published by Weinstein Books. Kat, Marie was your older sister by how much?
She was 10 years older than me.
And do you think that she could have written fiction, maybe have been a novelist instead of a war reporter, because she was such a fine stylist?
I think her writing ability and her, she was absolutely brilliant. She could have certainly done any of that, but her character was so suited to journalism. And some of the things Paul mentioned about her tenaciousness, it applied to everything. Life with Marie was an adventure, you know. Looking for a pig. I liked pigs. She would go to the ends of the earth to find a pig on Long Island, you know, that I could see. It wasn't.
Paul, you've also, your book is so well written. Are most photojournalists also frustrated writers?
No, I think everyone nearly fell over when they could find out how to write my name.
Well, you're a former soldier. Go ahead. Did you do a lot of writing?
No, I really didn't. I used to write the odd pieces for papers, you know, 800, 1,000 words. So I'd never written anything in a longer form than, you know, like I say, 1,000 words. It was just something I'd always love to. I think everyone somewhere has a book in them, and it's probably wise that most people don't write the book. But when I was when I got out and I was in hospital, I was really, really on a lot of painkillers and a lot of morphine, in fact. So I woke up one day in a bit of a haze, and there was a lady, Annabelle Morello, from Peter Fraser Dunlop, an agent, and said, you know, would you like to write a book? And I was just so, I just said yes to anything.
You're so drugged up you didn't know what you're saying anyway.
I was like, yeah, no problem.
Now, this is when you were injured in the same event where Marie was killed.
That's right, yeah.
Now, you're a former soldier. Do you think that helped you in doing this kind of work as a photojournalist and a filmmaker in these war zones?
Yeah, I think initially after I got out of the army, I was a bit like, well, that was, you know, that was a little slight waste of time, really. Then, you know, now I can kill someone with a tin opener kind of thing. How's that going to work me in real life? And it was only when I actually started doing the job and, you know, the shells started falling that, you know, stuff that I'd learned 20 years ago came straight back to memory and almost instinctive reaction to things, which countless times, I'm sure, without doubt, saved my life. I mean, even especially in the house when that day when we were shelled and I had a huge hole in the back of my leg, which instantly I knew that I had to get a tourniquet on. So that many, many times on many occasions that military training did serve me, you know, to great advantage.
Well, it's hard for many people to imagine doing this kind of work voluntarily. In addition to the danger, you have to endure some incredible physical discomforts, like crawling repeatedly through a 3-kilometer-long tunnel covered in mud in the dark. And you and Marie did that to get in and out of homes. Yet you emphasize in your book that Marie was not a war junkie or an adrenaline junkie, and you've written that you resent that war reporters are viewed as dysfunctional thrill killers. So are they no different than the rest of us when it comes to crawling through a 3-kilometer-long tunnel to get our jobs done?
You mean you don't do it? No, I think, you know, they were just challenged. They're obstacles that are in the way to your real job. The real job is to get amongst the people and be there. And, you know, the only way you can do that on many of these occasions is to do something that, you know, you would normally not consider in life. That was just part of the challenge. I mean, I assure you that I would not be crawling through tunnels as a hobby. I mean, I look at people jumping off, you know, with elastic bands tied around their waist into canyons, and I think that's silly.
Well, you live in Belfast, don't you?
No, I'm here doing a thing for the Red Cross. Everyone was laughing at me when they said I was going to Belfast again. He's at it again. And it's really rather peaceful, apart from a guy breaking bottles in a bin outside my window, who is now shut up. But, no, I don't like the term war junkies or, you know, adrenaline junkies. That, you know, I would certainly never call Marie that. Neither of us used to like being shot at. It leaves you feeling quite sick.
She was just so driven to get the people's story out. And oddly, she's very confident, but oddly humble when it came to her writing, because she just always thought if she could only write it better to convey the horror she was seeing, people would care. You know, and she would go into these black periods when she realized people didn't really care as much as she did.
Well, you feel like you're doing God's work and that you're going to change people's minds.
Right.
And then you discover that they read what you do or they hear a radio show where I feel like I've just exposed some terrible thing. And then they just move on.
Yeah. And she was endlessly fascinated with the Middle East. It was such a complex culture. She read just voraciously. She was really an expert, and you sort of see that in her collected writings, the development of her knowledge of the area.
She could unravel that. You know, I mean, I've spent a lot of time at the end, but, you know, I used to defer to Marie all the time when it came to the whole mindset of the place. She really could figure them out and get to the heart of it. And that was it. You know, the parts about going through tunnels and through minefields was an adjunct to it. That was what had to be done to get to them places. It was never a reason in itself for Marie to do any of them things. You know, she knew the way in to that story, and that was the way. If it had to be that way, it had to be that way.
She'd rather ride in a limo. I'm sure she would have rather ridden in a limo.
My guests are Marie Colvin, Kat Colvin, sister of Marie Colvin, who's the subject of this discussion, and Paul Conroy, who worked with Marie Colvin. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Kat, Marie was an American, yet she wrote for a British newspaper. How did that work out?
Well, it's interesting. I did talk to her a bit about that. I was hoping to get her back to New York for selfish reasons when I moved back. But one thing in the paper she wrote for, she was allowed to write in the first person, which she really felt was more impactful and came more naturally to her. And she thought that she could better convey what she was witnessing. Where here in the Times, for example, that's not considered a style that would be appropriate.
And fairly soon after she started there, she was named the paper's Middle East correspondent, and then she became one of its foreign affairs correspondents. And wasn't she the first reporter to interview Muammar Gaddafi and Ronald Reagan after Ronald Reagan bombed Tripoli in 1986?
It was a very funny story because she was a really young reporter. She didn't know she was supposed to go to the media center and get a briefing, so she just went around knocking on the palace door, essentially, and he gave her an audience in the middle of the night. When the bombs dropped on Libya that time, she had been calling around to try to get a follow-up interview, and Gaddafi thought Marie was calling to warn him. He had 6 or 7, you know, houses and numbers, and he was convinced she was trying to save him, and after that they were fast friends.
Did she tell these stories when the family got together?
She told.
One day I was speaking to Yasser Arafat, and he said.
Well, we, but jokingly, it's hard to believe. It's hard to explain what a sense of humor she had about these situations. She called. You know, our forms of communication changed over the years as technology changed, but mostly we talked on the phone. And you know, I have orders from everywhere. If my sister calls, I'll drop everything and take it because you never know if she can call back again.
Paul, in your book, you focus on the last assignment you and Marie did together in 2012 when you were reporting on the siege of Homs. Syria wasn't allowing foreign correspondents into the country. How did you and Marie get into it?
We went to Lebanon where we knew people. We had contacts, and it was just a long series of meetings. You know, one person would introduce us to another, and eventually we were taken by a combination of the Free Syrian Army and gun smugglers and people taking medicines in. So we slowly went up through the Bekaa Valley to the Lebanese-Syrian border at night, and then we kind of jumped on the back of motorbikes at midnight and crept through minefields. So it was a really long and dangerous way in. And once you got inside of Syria, it wasn't like Libya where there were rebel-held positions where you could get in and be made safe. You know, once you got inside of Syria, you were within, you know, Assad's forces were never any more than a kilometre away. So the whole process was dangerous in itself. But the option that we didn't even really have, because we never got visas, would have been to have gone to Damascus and been surrounded by government minders, and we'd be taken on little field trips to places that they'd secured. And that was not something that was in Marie's nor my style. We really wanted to get amongst what we knew was happening in Homs, and to do that we had to put a lot of faith in people we'd never met.
And crawl through that tunnel.
And crawl through the tunnel, which was that was the crowning glory, really. We thought we'd been through everything getting in, and then at the very end they said, oh yes, and there's the tunnel, and we both looked at each other and mouthed the word tunnel.
Well, but I'm curious about the people you met in the Free Syrian Army, because there's a lot of discussion in this country about who you support and who you don't support, and the sense we're getting these days is that most of the rebels are people we would probably be no happier with running Syria than Assad.
No, that's something that is unfortunately built up in the 2.5 years that nobody's actually done anything. When me and Marie met the Free Syrian Army, these guys were deserters. They'd come aside from the army because they, A, objected to opening fire on their own people, but B, their own people were being slaughtered by the army. So these guys literally ran away, took up guns, and were used purely as a defensive force. When we were there, the Free Syrian Army would not attack army positions. They thought that they were their brothers, that they might be killing family, and their sole existence of the Free Syrian Army at that point was a protective force to be used in defense of their own people. Over the time, it was, as we've seen the Islamic and the Takfiris and Jabhat al-Nusra come in and take the place of any international effort. But believe me, the people who got us into Homs and the way we were treated in Homs, not just because we were journalists, just because we were human beings, that has been lost in the kind of Assad has seen the default lines and drop sticks of dynamite in it and turn it into a sectarian war now. It was never a war per se. It was a popular uprising, non-armed and non-violent, that these guys sought to protect. And over time, I think through lack of any real international interest, you know, that vacuum was filled by people who have essentially spoilt the name of the revolution. That's what they were. When we were in Homs, one guy did come up, given it the whole Al-Qaeda angle, and they just put a bag on his head and sent him back to Lebanon, because they were quite aware that if they were associated with the extremists, then the position and the viewpoint on them would change. So I would argue against the fact that the average Free Syrian Army member was approached anything like what the regime could throw at them.
Now, Kat, were you aware here in New York of the danger that Paul and Marie were in? They learned as they started to move through Syria that Assad had decreed that any Western journalist caught near Homs was to be executed on the spot and their bodies thrown into the battlefield.
I was aware of the danger. I have to say, very unlike my mother, who constantly worried, I always thought Marie was invincible. She'd come out of so many life. I don't mean to say that it happened all the time, but she would come out with these funny stories. Her life was threatened so many times. I didn't perceive it as I knew it was more dangerous than ever other situations, but I simply didn't accept in my mind that anything could happen to her.
Now, Paul, you and Marie stayed in a secret makeshift media center while you were in Homs. Were there any other Western journalists there when you arrived? And didn't you come later to believe that Assad's forces had specifically targeted that center in an attempt to kill foreign journalists?
Yeah, when we arrived in the media center, Arwa Damon from CNN was there at the time. She'd been in for a few days at that point. We spent 2 days together in the first time we went into Homs through the tunnel. Then it was a lot of intelligence, and we got lots of messages saying that the Syrian army were about to attack, coming as land forces. So we were, you know, in the space of an hour, they decided to get a lot of people out. So we were dragged back through the tunnel again. For safety's sake, they just said, you know, if they come in, you will be killed. They didn't invade, so me and Marie went back in on the Monday to the media center through the tunnel once more. And the situation, even over that few days, it deteriorated so badly that it was almost unworkable. And at that point, we decided to do interviews and send footage to BBC World, CNN, and Channel 4. And it was after we released that footage and did interviews that Marie rather eloquently described the situation. I would say some of the best broadcasts of all time when it came to war and describing the situation. She was so passionate, and she drew such a vivid picture of life for the people of Baba Amra at that time. And it was the next morning at 7:30 that the building took direct hits. But the pattern of fire, because I was an artillery spotter and observer, and I realized they were in fact bracketing, walking the shells into the building. And seconds later, I realized the next shells were going to hit the building, and exactly as I thought, the building was attacked.
And then Marie died instantly when the building was hit. You suffered some terrible wounds to one of your legs. How did you get out, and how long were you hospitalized?
We lay in the rubble for about 20 minutes afterwards, because once they saw movement, they started shelling again, and I was trying to fix my leg in the rubble.
You applied a tourniquet.
Yeah, and I'd also gone to look for Marie and found Marie. We waited about 20 minutes for the shelling to stop, and I was thrown in a rather battered vehicle along with Edith Bouvier, who was injured, a French journalist. And we were taken to the makeshift field clinic where we were treated. You know, it was quite basic treatment. There were no painkillers, anything. They just cut the dead meat off my leg, sewed it up a bit, patched it up. And we waited then for 5 days. I think we were trapped for 5 days under incredible bombardment. When once again we were taken to the tunnel, and this time they had a cut down motorbike that they laid me on the back of, which went in the tunnel, and I was driven three quarters of the way through when we came across a blockage where a shell had hit, and then I had to kind of crawl through holes and get out the other side, and eventually, you know, with over a period of, I think it was 3 days, I made it from there, step by step on the back of motorbikes and in the backs of trucks to the Jordanian border.
Have you retired?
Border. No, oh, indeed not. No, I'm just I'm in a stage of physio. I can walk around now. I can do all of that. It's not very elegant when I tried running, but I am trying to get the strength up to get back. It's always been my goal. You know, when I had Marie on my shoulder every single day in that hospital, kind of, you know, egging me on. And I really felt I owed it to her, A, not to shut up about Syria, and B, to get back and carry on with my job. You know, I'm convinced that's what Marie would have wanted, and I'll do me best to do that.
Well, we have very little time. In fact, we are over our time. But, Kat, I understand a portion of the proceeds from the sale of this book will go to the Marie Colvin Memorial Fund. What is that fund going to do?
I've really tried to channel my energy into a legacy for Marie. So our main recipient to date has been the Marie Colvin Center for International Reporting at Stony Brook School of Journalism. And all the proceeds go to the fund, which funds humanitarian, educational, and journalistic efforts.
Kat Colvin has put together On the Front Line, the collected journalism of Marie Colvin. It is published by Harper Press. Paul Conroy has written his story and Marie's story as Under the Wire, Marie Colvin's final assignment. It's published by Weinstein Books. And my great thanks to both of you for being on our show today.
Thank you, Leonard.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Bye, Paul.
Thanks to both. Kat, I'll call you shortly.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Cheers now.